GreenSense is brought to you by JLT Specialty USA, the world's largest energy insurance broker, serving the entire energy continuum. Visit jltus.com.
Welcome to GreenSense, a weekly look at the people, policies, and innovations that are changing our world. Here's Robert Colangelo.
Welcome. That's me, scientist, author, and environmental entrepreneur, and I'm going to be your host for this edition of GreenSense.
I'm Bob Kessler, executive producer. So how do you get people's attention on climate change? Well, what if it were true that it is threatening something that helps perk us up in the morning and in the afternoon and when you have a long road trip? Also, speaking of road trips, you and Tom Appel have been tooling around. You know, Robert, I know you said you thought that your minivan driving days were over. Looks like they aren't. And Tom has some news on an all-electric car.
All coming up on this week's edition of GreenSense.
Gentlemen, please calm down. Shh. Please listen to me. The bumps you feel are asteroids smashing into the hull of this ship. Also, we're flying without a navigational system and can't seem to change course.
Miss, are you telling us absolutely everything?
Not exactly. We're also out of coffee.
Sometimes it takes a strong statement, like that one from the movie Airplane 2, to really drive the point home. Yes, we could be out of coffee thanks to climate change. A new study written in part by Dr. Taylor Ricketts, director of the Gund Institute for Environment at the University of Vermont, says that could be the case. To tell us more, we're joined by Dr. Ricketts right now, all the way from Costa Rica. Hello, Dr. Ricketts.
Hello.
What's it like in Costa Rica these days?
It's where I'm living. It's the wet season right now, so it's raining a lot, but it's beautiful and warm every day, and I'm sitting in a valley surrounded by coffee rising up the mountains around me, so it's a suitable place to be talking about this project.
Were you impacted at all by all these intense hurricanes that have hit the coastal areas?
No, we watched them go by through the Caribbean and on into the U.S., so they missed Costa Rica, but it was horrible to read the news from here.
We've had a number of guests on that have talked about climate change and the warming of the oceans, and it seems like there is a much more direct cause and effect between climate change and severe weather patterns, and that's why we have you on the show. We wanted to talk a little bit about the connection between climate change and coffee production. So why don't you tell us a little bit about that since you're surrounded by the coffee fields of Costa Rica?
Yeah, so climate change is going to affect agriculture in a variety of different ways, but one of the clearest ones is going to move them around. It's going to move crops around. It's going to change where crops are suitable to be grown. And that's true for coffee like it is for many other crops. We find that coffee is going to have to move uphill as climate warms, and there's simply less land uphill. Any mountain is sort of a cone, so when you go up a mountain, you find less land there. So we're going to find a pretty significant reduction in the land that's suitable for growing coffee under climate change.
Does that mean that coffee will stay in the same locale? It's just going to be moving higher elevations, or are you going to be able to grow coffee in other areas where it was never grown before?
So it's a mix of both of those things, actually. Coffee is going to keep being suitable to be grown in some of the places it's currently grown. It's going to expand into some areas further uphill. But also much more prevalent than that is it's going to have its range reduced on the downhill side. So we're going to see more land become unsuitable for coffee production than new land become newly suitable. And that's one of the problems that we highlight in the paper.
How long does it take to build up a coffee plantation so that the trees are bearing fruit? So if we started from scratch, give us an idea of how long it would take before you'd actually see the beans.
Yeah, that's a great question because they're trees. They're small trees and you have to plant them and prune them and let them grow for a while before they produce well for you. It's sort of more like an orchard than a corn crop. And so it's going to take usually 3 to 5 years is what I think I understand to get a profitable crop out of a newly planted zone of coffee. So there's a time lag there.
And people drink coffee multiple times, typically during the day, and I don't think they're going to be very tolerant of a 3 to 5 year time lag. How much will coffee production be reduced, and how soon are we going to start seeing an impact in production from climate change?
That's a good question, and I'm glad you brought it up, because 3 to 5 years does sound like a long time, but the effects of climate change are also going to be slow. So these effects, if we see them, are projected out to 2050 in our paper. So it's going to be a decades-long, very slow shift. It's one of the difficult things about climate change, about casting it as an urgent problem, is these things are going to take a while. So compared to the decades-long change in the climate and suitability for coffee, I think 3 to 5 years is not really going to be the problem. Coffee has expanded and contracted before due to market forces. So people grow it a lot when its price is high and they grow other things when the price declines. So we've seen these sorts of orchards come and go before. So that time lag is not the thing I think I worry most about.
What do you worry most about?
So I actually worry less about whether the coffee drinkers of the world will tolerate this. I'm drinking coffee right now. I drink it every day. Many, many people do, as you know. So it's easy to think about like, wow, you know, this might make my espresso in New York City more expensive or something. But the thing I worry about more than that is coffee is grown by 25 million people in 60 countries around the world, most of them developing countries, and probably 100 million people are involved in the production and distribution of coffee, almost all of them rural and poor. So we like our coffee, but it's also the main livelihood of millions of rural poor people in communities worldwide. And those are the people who I worry about more than the coffee drinkers in North America and Europe.
I'm talking with Dr. Taylor Ricketts, director of the Gund Institute for the Environment at the University of Vermont, about climate change and its impact on coffee production. Taylor, the tipping point is defined as the point at which a series of small changes become significant to cause a more important change. You know, we're starting to see more and more scientists putting the effects of climate change into common sense terms that are much more understandable. Do you see that this coffee shortage or this inability to find enough land to grow to be the tipping point where people now start to take climate change seriously and start to move into action?
That's a great question. I'm not sure if coffee itself will be a tipping point. And I think it's the nature of tipping points that many things accumulate to finally tip a dynamic, a new direction. So I'm not sure we can put a point a finger at any one thing, but it is one of those close to home issues. People do love their coffee, and millions of people drink it every day around the world, as we've said. So this does bring a somewhat vague and distant and difficult to get your arms around issue more concretely close to home. But I also think other things are doing that, and the recent hurricanes battering the Caribbean and the U.S. are other examples. We can't ever pin one specific hurricane on climate change, but we can predict that they'll get stronger and more frequent under climate change, and that's what we're seeing. So the more that the effects of climate change affect our daily lives today, right now, not in the future, the more I think people will take it seriously. Yep, coffee is an example of that, but so are these storms that seem to be, especially this year, hammering the U.S. and the Caribbean.
What kind of climatic effects can devastate a coffee crop? So we know we can have a slow change in climate, but can you get hurricanes, heavy rains, or other natural disasters that can wipe out a whole crop?
Yeah, that's a good question, too. I think that's a little less likely and a little less high on the list of concerns than some of the other effects of climate change. Those include just getting too hot. So coffee grows up in the mountains for a reason. It needs tropical areas, but relatively cool tropical areas. That's why it's a mountain-grown crop. And so as the earth warms, so will the temperatures around those coffee plants. And the idea is, or the worry is, it'll just simply get too warm slowly for coffee and it'll have to move uphill, or they'll have to switch to different crops. That's why coffee is grown under shade, in part, to keep the coffee out of the direct sun and therefore cooler. One other problem with climate change is very often it changes pests of many crops. Insect pests can often grow faster and reproduce faster when it's warmer. And things like funguses and rusts also do better in warmer, moister temperature regimes. So those things, just the sheer temperature and the pests, I think are the main things people worry about for coffee.
Well, John Lennon said there's no problems, just solutions. What's the solution here?
Yeah, so that's one of the interesting things about this paper. I mean, people are really interested in the future of coffee, but one of the things we investigated here was whether the pollinators of coffee might soften the blow a little bit. So pollinators help coffee grow. They improve the yields and the quality of coffee. Coffee can produce something without pollinators, but pollinators improve that. And we wanted to know whether in the future range of coffee there would still be bees, and whether bees would also be suffering from climate change and therefore exacerbate the problem, or whether they might be really abundant in the new range of coffee and kind of soften the blow. And what we found was a little bit of both. There are places where bees are going to be really diverse and abundant and might soften the blow a little bit from the reductions of yield we might see from climate change itself. Of course, there are other places where there'll be kind of a double whammy. Land will get less suitable for coffee and less suitable for the bees. So that's one thing that I think is a potential solution, is to make sure in the future range of coffee that we're doing everything else right. And one of those things is make sure it's getting sufficient pollination.
What about innovation? What about new technologies, new techniques, new processes to be able to get harvest to the consumers with less waste?
Yeah, that's a great question. And there's several things to that. One is we can, of course, develop new varieties of coffee that are more temperature tolerant. And that, I'm sure, is happening. I'm not involved in that work, but I can only imagine it's happening quickly. And this is yet one more reason to do that. One problem with that is often these hybrids don't taste as well. It's still the case that some of the original varieties of coffee are still the most sought after from a flavor point of view. So some of these hybrids have made coffee more robust, things like pests and temperature, but it's taken a hit in terms of the flavor profile. That's one technological shift. Another simpler one, frankly, is some farmers may have to just switch out of coffee and grow other things. And I think we have to be ready for that. It doesn't sound very high tech, but it is a really important form of tech transfer, as it were, of assistance in farmers to help adapt to climate change for their main livelihood.
Taylor, thank you for joining us on Green Sense and taking a moment out of paradise there to share your thoughts and concerns and connecting coffee to climate change.
I really appreciate your interest. Thanks very much.
That's Dr. Taylor Ricketts, Director of the Gunn Institute for Environment at the University of Vermont. I'm Robert Colangelo. This is Green Sense. Subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher when you visit greensensefarms.com.
This is Bob Kessler, executive producer of Green Sense Radio. Every week, we cover environmental issues and meet passionate people and sustainable innovators. You might have noticed we do it with very few commercials. Our advertisers, they're just part of what supports Green Sense. We need the help of our listeners, also passionate people who care about the planet and know the value of independent media, which matters now more than ever. We've just launched our fundraising drive so you can help us continue to bring you informative and inspiring shows. Your contributions will cover our small production staff, which seeks out and schedules interviews, edits them, and puts together Green Sense every week. Plus, there's the cost of online hosting and studio equipment. So when you visit greensensefarms.com, click on Radio Show to make a contribution via Podbean. Takes just a few minutes, and as we often say on the program, individual actions multiplied by millions can yield big results. So if you're inspired by our positive and informative shows, we're asking you to help keep Green Sense going. Visit greensensefarms.com and click Radio Show to contribute to our fundraising drive via Podbean. On behalf of all of us at Green Sense Radio, thank you.
It's Green Automotive News Time with Tom Appel, publisher of Consumer Guide Automotive. We do have a green road test to get into, and it's the Chrysler Pacifica. But before that, we're going to get some news on the Nissan Leaf. Welcome, Tom.
Hey, thanks for having me.
What's been happening with the Nissan Leaf that's newsworthy?
Yeah, the Nissan Leaf, which has been around since 2010, is being redesigned for the 2018 model year. A lot of speculation about what this vehicle would be and how it might address the challenges that are now incumbent upon it based on the Tesla Model 3 and the Chevy Bolt with a B, both of which are now on the market. And it's an interesting decision that Nissan made to sort of go with a half step that I think makes it a far more compelling offering.
And what's a half step?
The car is not entirely new. It uses the same architecture as before, and it doesn't go to a gigantic battery. When the Leaf was introduced, it had a 24 kilowatt hour battery, and it was good for about 84 miles. Later, a 30 kilowatt hour battery was available, and that was good for about 107. For 2018, the styling is significantly updated, as is the cabin, and a new 40 kilowatt hour battery is introduced, which is good for 150 miles.
And Tom, why are they maybe nipping around the edges and not going all the way to that much higher mileage like you're getting in the Bolt and the Tesla?
That is a great question, but I think it looks to me as if there's white space here. There's a lot of cars now that go about 100 miles, and there's the Tesla Model 3 and the Chevy Bolt that break 200 miles. We're going to have the Leaf alone in the 150-mile range, and there's a couple significant advantages to that. The vehicle's slightly lighter because it's losing less battery. It costs significantly less as well. Compared to the other two vehicles I just mentioned, the Leaf is going to be about $7,500 cheaper, and that's significant for a lot of people. And 150 miles will work for a number of people as well. So there's a lot going on here. Additionally, there's new technology. There's their ProPilot, which is sort of an autonomous, a step towards autonomous driving. And they're going to use what they call their e-pedal, which is one-pedal driving, which a lot of people like in hybrid or electric vehicles, where the regenerative braking is so strong, you don't need to ever tap the brakes. You can just let off the gas. It takes some getting used to, but a lot of people love it, and that's available in the Leaf now.
Tom, we both have test driven the Leaf. It's been a fantastic car. With these new changes, how does that affect the driving performance?
One of the good things, too, that's happening for 2018 is a big bump in horsepower. So it's going from around 100 horsepower to, I think, 140 or 150 horsepower. I have not driven the vehicle yet, but 0 to 60 times improved dramatically.
Any other changes that you like in the Leaf?
Yeah, the styling is much more distinct now. This looks like a member of the Nissan family. It has what's called the floating C-pillar in back, which is a new Nissan design language thing, the new V-motion grille. It looks like a very modern vehicle.
It's fascinating how the hybrid and electric cars have gone through a transformation, have become much more stylish. They're not the awkward cars that they were first when they came out. Thoughts on that?
Yeah, that's a great point. The first Mitsubishi I and the first Nissan Leaf and really the first Chevy Volt all had, call it distinct styling, but I think they very much meant for these vehicles to call attention to themselves. And I think we've gotten past that point now. I think that you'll recognize a Leaf when you see it, but it no longer looks like some sort of strange styling outlier.
And I think this is all part of a maturing of a marketplace. Oftentimes, when new markets start, things are very different. Then they start to normalize, and you're starting to see the hybrids and the plug-ins being very normal and drive just like regular cars. So that's a good thing. And that also means that this is starting to get more widely accepted. And that's great for the environment, and it's great for those who like to drive these kind of cars. Anything else on the Leaf, Dom?
No, should be on sale new. This will be available starting at $30,000 in all 50 states. So it is one of the electric vehicles you can get everywhere.
Well, let's move on to a car that I've test driven, which I was really wowed at. My kids are much older now. This is a minivan, the Chrysler Pacifica. My impression of minivans was never to drive one again. I was through that stage of young kids, and the original minivans were just not the kind of car I enjoyed. But this Pacific Hybrid Platinum is a whole nother level. This is a luxury, well-appointed minivan that I hate to even call it a minivan. I was just wowed by it. And the fact that it's a hybrid and can get 32 miles per gallon average, and then when you plug it in with the electric charge, you're getting somewhere around 84 mpge. So I'm shocked at it. Your thoughts on this?
Yeah, it's an incredibly impressive vehicle. And the minivan market has shrunk a little bit, and the last players in it are stepping up their game. There's an all-new Honda Odyssey. The Toyota Sienna was freshened a couple years ago, and the Pacifica was all new 2 years ago, replacing the Town & Country in Chrysler's lineup. And it is, in fact, very much a luxury vehicle, at least in the Platinum trim level. Chrysler calls this a hybrid. It's really a plug-in hybrid, as you noted, with 34 miles of electric range. That's stated, plus then it operates as a hybrid vehicle. In our testing, we averaged 36 miles per gallon overall, but that's because one of our testers went on a very long road trip. A lot of people can get by with that mileage and won't have to buy gas during the week, which makes this work. It rides, it drives, it handles very much like a conventional vehicle, doesn't feel too much like a hybrid. And as you mentioned, yeah, it's beautiful inside.
What I liked were the four captain chairs. Each had a video in it with a headset so that you can watch movies and really lull the kids to sleep, or even the grandparents, or your customers if you're driving it around in business. It's very easy to get in and out of, very well appointed with nice leather features, and it has a third row seat, which really allows you to carry quite a lot of passengers there. I also liked all the safety features, and I like the autonomous controls that are creeping into the car. The lane changing features, if you go out of your lane, it pulls you back in. The safety features with sensors on the perimeter of the car, so if you're going to back into something, it gives you a warning. So you're as I said, you start to see the autonomous creep in all these new vehicles.
Yeah, absolutely. This car is really just a couple of options away from being what they call level 2 autonomous, where you can actually take your hands off the steering wheel. But in terms of highway safety, yeah, it's big leaps over the previous vehicle. Interesting, too, is the pricing of this vehicle. Because it has an 8 kilowatt-hour battery, it qualifies for a partial federal tax credit on your taxes of $3,750, which for the most part offsets the price of going with the hybrid vehicle. Essentially, if you go with the Pacifica hybrid and you qualify for the full tax rebate, you're getting the hybrid for free, which is really compelling.
It's hard not to pick the hybrid version with that incentive available. The car I drove had a base price right around $45,000. With options, it was right around $48,000, which is very pricey for a minivan. But when you look at the luxury you're getting and the fact that it is a hybrid and depending on how far you drive each day, you may never have to put gas in it. It's quite a deal.
And that is something you have to factor in as well. If you can go during the week, not going on any long trips without gas, that's just all free money.
Well, Tom, it's always a pleasure to talk with you, and we'll look forward to catching up with you in a couple of weeks and test driving our next new car.
Looking forward to it.
Visit consumerguide.com to read Tom Appel's reviews and all the other great writers at Consumer Guide Automotive. I'm Robert Colangelo, and this is GreenSense. Subscribe to our podcast at greensensefarms.com. We're on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play. Thanks for listening to this week's edition of GreenSense. Send any suggestions or ideas to robert@greensenseshow.com. We're always interested to hear our listeners' comments. We'll be back next week with some great guests that hopefully will inspire you. Subscribe to the GreenSense Radio podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play by visiting greensensefarms.com and view the list of radio stations that air our show. Our goal is to be an honest broker of sustainable information so that you can make informed decisions. Stay fresh, keep innovating, because when you're green, you grow.
GreenSense is recorded in the Duneland ecosystem on the eastern shores of Lake Michigan at GreenSense Farms, the largest indoor commercial vertical farm in the world. We walk the walk and talk the talk, growing leafy green vegetables 24/7, free of pesticides, herbicides, with non-GMO seeds, conserving resources, and reducing waste. Watch us grow. The program is copyright GreenSense Farms, all rights reserved.
GreenSense is brought to you by JLT Specialty USA, the world's largest energy insurance broker, serving the entire energy continuum. Visit jltus.com.